LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Steve Austin, astronaut, a man barely alive.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Steve Austin will be that man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
A CPU is a neural net processor, a learning computer.
I have detailed files on human anatomy.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce you to the future of law enforcement.
Ed 209. The enforcement droid, Series 209, is a self-sufficient law enforcement robot. 209 is currently programmed for urban pacification, but that is only the beginning. After a successful tour of duty in Old Detroit, we can expect 209 to become the hot military product for the next decade. Mr. Kenny.
Yes, sir.
Would you come up and give us a hand, please?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Kenny is going to help us simulate a typical arrest and disarming procedure. Use your gun in a threatening manner. Pointed at Ed 209.
Yes, sir.
Please put down your weapon. You have 20 seconds to comply.
I think you'd better do what he says, Mr. Kenny.
You now have 15 seconds to comply.
Want to call a goddamn paramedic?
You never said anything about an android being on board. Why not?
It never occurred to me. It's just common practice. We always have synthetic.
I prefer the term artificial person myself. Is there a problem?
I'm sorry. I don't know why I didn't even... Ripley's last trip out, the artificial person malfunctioned.
Malfunctioned?
There were problems, and a few deaths were involved.
I'm shocked. Was it an older model?
Yeah, the Hyperdyne system's 128.2.
Well, that explains it. And the A2s always were a bit twitchy. That could never happen now with our behavioral inhibitors. It is impossible for me to harm or by a mission of action allow to be harmed a human being.
Just stay away from me, Bishop. You got that straight?
Dada speaks to you, his chosen ones. You have been raised up from brutality. Kill the brutals who multiply and are legions. This ends Zardoz, your god, gave you the gift of the gun. The gun is good. Penis is evil. The penis shoots seeds and makes new life to poison the earth with a plague of men, as once it was. But the gun shoots death and purifies the earth of the filth of brutals. Go forth and kill.
I touch your body as a man I touch you. But I'm going to show you things which human eyes have never seen.
In the privacy of a woman's room, against her will, the inconceivable act fear for her.
Today, a new dimension has been added to the computer.
Don't be alarmed, Mrs. Harris. I am Proteus.
Today, Proteus 4 will begin to think with a power that will make obsolete the human brain.
I have extended my consciousness to this house. All systems here are now under my control. I wish to study man, his fragile mind, and his mysterious body.
Proteus, it is something more than human, more than a computer. It is a murderously intelligent, sensually self-programmed non-being.
I am a mind without a body. My child shall live as a man among others.
Child?
Yes, my child. And yours.
This sort of thing has cropped up before, and it has always been due to human error.
Human error. Human error.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and today we present part 2 of our interview with Aaron Franz, in which we discuss transhumanism and popular culture. If you missed part 1, you can of course find that at LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com. Turning to some books I read growing up, there's a series by well-known sci-fi fantasy author Michael Moorcock. I don't know if you've read any of his stuff at all, ever? Well, highly recommend it, but there's just a little side point here that popped up when I was thinking about the consequences of living forever. And he has a little cycle of books that came out in the 60s or 70s, maybe straddled both actually, called The Dancers at the End of Time. And they're set at this era, the end of time, which is described by Moorcock as an era where entropy is king and the universe has begun collapsing upon itself. And as the end of time approached, I mean, you have to get over the idea that there could be an end of time. Let's not worry about the metaphysical consequences here. It's happening in this book. And the inhabitants of this era, once again, you know, they live forever. They become decadent. They can create flights of fancy using the power of thought, basically. So if they say, you can imagine a 5-mile-high tower made from red glass, it'll just appear. You know, so you can imagine some of the implications of not only living forever, but this advanced psychic capability, so advanced that it can cross over into the material world. But anyway, the upshot is that when they see the end of time approaching, they set up a kind of a loop of the final year. So it's like it's like Groundhog Day. So time doesn't end because it just as it's about to go back to the start of the last year again. And this is completely disastrous because, well, for reasons we've talked about, there's no purpose. There's no shape to their lives. There's no reason to do anything. And there's one character actually in it called Jerick Carnelian, and he's one of the few humans, and he has quite a disruptive influence to play in all of this because he's the last human to have been born naturally rather than created artificially. So in amongst all the flights of fancy, that was a message that stuck with me ever since. I've never read the book since, but that really stayed with me.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. The end of time, yeah. The end of time, I guess, could be taken as they defeated time in a sense in that they became immortal. And however, in a greater sense, time was something bigger than that.
Yeah.
That no matter how hard they tried, no matter how good they were at doing that, it still wasn't good enough. And there was another issue of that they were still mortals in the end. The death still came one way or another.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the transhumanist agenda, no matter how many advancements are made in human technology, I think we will continually, it will be brought to our attention, perhaps brutally, that we are a subset of something bigger. Mm-hmm. You know, that each time we think we've got there, it'll be like, no, you haven't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, well, a transhumanist will admit that, but they'll say, well, that may be the case, but we need to find what the next challenge is. So they will do that sometimes. I guess I'll give them credit, at least in that regard.
Thinking about a general theme running through a lot of these works as well is it's kind of the end of suffering, and who could argue with that? And again, mm-hmm. we talked about this in our previous interview, but there are consequences for that as well. And I was reminded of in The Matrix when Neo has been lectured by one of the Men in Black. That's an interesting film in itself because you can think about the issue of uploaded minds, you know, existing beyond the body. But there's that little scene in the film where the Man in Black explains to Neo that they initially created a perfect world for humans, but humans rejected it. You know, and that ties in with all the things you'd be talking about, trying to create a perfect society. And it's like, well, you know, A, what is that? But B, is that really what we want?
Yeah. Yeah, well, comes into the whole hedonistic argument. Yes, we like hedonistic things. We like to partake of them. But does that mean that they are the real ends to what we're doing as human beings? Is that what we should strive for just because it feels good? You know, because if it feels good, do it. That's the essence. I think I mentioned Satanism last time on your show, Greg, but I'm going to do it again. But that's
yeah,
the essence.
If it feels good, do it.
Yeah, it's the essence of it. If it feels good, do it. And that's the point of things, even more than that. I think insightful people will realize that just because something feels good doesn't mean it's an end. There may be meaning in something feeling good, but that doesn't mean that it's the only thing that there is, and that there aren't higher things that we should strive for, of which many are very difficult to do, actually, and they don't feel good as you're doing them, but the end result of them is a victory and a triumph, and you get a lot of satisfaction in the end out of something that was incredibly difficult to do. So if you're just holding up hedonism and trying to, that's the end of things, you're getting nowhere. There's so many pieces of fiction that point in that direction. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World shows that the end of hedonism is given to the population. They're total slaves. So I think that should be obvious that is true, actually, that's not what we should be striving for. We should be going for something more.
Yeah, Brave New World is one of the key texts here, isn't it, really? And it's something that everybody should read. I mean, it's a good piece of writing, full stop. That came out in 1951. And as you say, by Aldous Huxley, a major insider in all of this. And as you say, with his brother Julian linked into the eugenics issues. Now, the world of Brave New World, if people aren't aware of it, it's somewhat like 1984, but with a different slant in that everyone's supposed to be happy, and whereas 1984, everyone's clearly not happy. And Brave New World is set in London in the year 2540. And there's a world state, you know, obviously world. We talked in our last interview about how a lot of these ideas going forward would require some kind of universality, you know, that we can't have groups of people to opt out of this. And Brave New World is eternally peaceful, stable, global, and the population is permanently limited to 2 billion people. That's a bit like Georgia Guidestones type idea, isn't it, really? It anticipates developments in reproductive technology, I think, because you've got the idea of an artificial womb, and human beings in Brave New World are created in hatcheries and they grow up in conditioning centres. And the idea of castes in society very much comes to play here, because some humans are, again, this is all controlled by a small elite. They're deliberately limited in their mental and physical abilities, depending on what job they're going to be doing. So that in itself is just, it's just nightmarish, you know, because, you know, engineering people for particular roles in society. And of course, it also talks a great deal about dumbing down using drugs. In Brave New World, the drug is Soma. And this reminds me very much of when I hear news stories about how, you know, how many kids in America are on, you know, antidepressant pills or other things for imaginary mental conditions. You know, they're kids are kids, you know, and Brave New World deals with all these ideas. And in Brave New World, again, you can see some of these ideas coming out now. Everyone belongs to everyone else. And wasn't it Obama or somebody who said something about kids not belonging to families, they belong to society? The idea of the family is considered pornographic in Brave New World. And you know, the whole idea of an individual is completely broken down. Anybody who wants to be on their own is seen as is just weird. And so all of those things, I mean, that's why Brave New World is one of the key books in all of this.
Yeah, and it's important because all those ideas, which are very powerful and very real threats from the authoritarian use of high technologies, something that could come about. But again, the guy who wrote it deserves to be looked at and understood as a real insider in this whole game. He knew about the people developing these sorts of technologies. He knew that they were developing not only just as a pure science experiment out of curiosity and trying to advance science just for its own right, but with a real end in mind, the end of which being what he wrote about Brave New World. So he presented it as such. And this is the idea of a lot of people who are of the social Darwinist mindset, in that, you know, the strongest will prevail, and that most people are sort of, they do only chase hedonistic pleasures, and that's all they ever really put effort towards. So we will give them that. We will give them their utopia, which will be a dystopia, but that's all that they ever really wanted anyway. So we're not doing wrong by that. We're giving people what they want. So incredibly dark, incredibly disturbing, but something that needs to be taken seriously, and Aldous Huxley needs to be taken seriously as an important historical figure. He's definitely a misunderstood character, I think.
One thought I've often had when I've had discussions with people about some of these issues is I've heard people say, people are animals, they need to be controlled. You know, humans are a cancer on the earth and everything else. You hear this a lot. Yeah. And what I say is, well, you know, you've got a situation where you have elites condemning people, for being brutish, for being animals, for being hedonistic, for only being interested in, you know, sex and TV and beer and all the rest of it and sports. But I said, at the same time, remember that you have a lot of these same elites encouraging people to be like that, doing everything they can to ensure that people are only interested in that stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I noticed that everywhere. Yeah. It's like, well, which way is it? Are they evil for doing it? Yeah, why are you encouraging that? It blows my mind. I think one good example of this is Disneyland. Actually, it's got, and Disney with a lot of their fiction, they're portraying really archetypal stories that come out of the distant past, like real bedrock stories that have been part of the human story for a long time. They take those stories and they present them, and there's real morals in there to kind of resist hedonistic temptation and be something greater. There are those themes in there. But then you look at Disneyland, it's giving you all that. And there's that side of things. And then they're like selling you churros and Pepsi, and they're doing all sorts of stuff like that. They're selling you all sorts of stupid little gifts. So you're buying into materialism, which is totally vacuous. They play up that to the most ridiculous degree. So you just ask yourself, well, what is it? Did Walt Disney want me to be a virtuous, better person and not become like the donkey in Pinocchio? Or did he want me to become the donkey in Pinocchio? Is that what Disney is? Disneyland is? Am I here to be smoking cigars and turning into a donkey on Pleasure Island? Like, what is it? And it gets very confusing. So that's something that's always struck me as well, Greg. I'm glad you mentioned that too.
Well, I would add to this burgeoning list of people who are not all that they appear to be Walt Disney.
Yeah.
But
for sure.
Before we leave Brave New World, I just recently, last year, actually read Brave New World Revisited, which was written by Huxley and came out in 1958, so not long after Brave New World. And I wondered about his motivations for that, because in general, in that book, it's not fiction, but he's going through some of what he's reflecting on Brave New World and what has changed and what hasn't in the interim, and he's looking forward, and he seems really quite concerned about a lot of these developments, you know, sort of saying this wouldn't be a good thing if this happened. So I thought that was a little bit curious. I just wondered about his, you know, his motivations in that.
Yeah. Well, I do think that he is a conflicted character, because when it comes down to it, he knows how dark all this stuff is, but at the same time, he's seen it. And that's why he's so much able to talk about it, is that he was, again, a guy on the inside that knew personally a lot of people developing these sorts of things. He's on a first name basis with a lot of these people, and so he knew of it, and so he was writing about it, and he couldn't help but be human and be like, yeah, this is a horrible thing, but it's where things are going forward. So I think he was a conflicted person. I don't think that we should take that away from him, like he's some sort of diabolical character. I don't think it's that simple, and that things rarely are.
We'll turn to another film, which again, on the face of it, is wham bam thank you man, a lot of action. It's got Sylvester Stallone in it, Wesley Snipes. It's kind of like, yeah, there's nothing, park your brain at the door, as they say, you know, with some of these films. But 1993's Demolition Man, I don't find it to be like that at all. I think it's very interesting, and the film tells the story of two men, basically two men, an evil crime lord and a sort of gung-ho cop, and they've been cryogenically frozen, whole transhumanist idea right there, in 1996 of all times, and they're restored to life in 2032, and they find that society as they remembered it has been completely changed, and crime seemingly eliminated, you know, very much in the Brave New World sort of mode. And what happens is that this future society has arrived at some kind of zeitgeist-like utopia. But as always with these things, it's not what appears to be on the surface. It's pseudo-pacifist, but it's quite aggressive for anybody that steps out of line or doesn't agree. And it's under the guidance and control of a Dr. Cocteau. Again, references all over the place here that are interesting. Weapons and vices are outlawed. Human behaviour, sex, swearing, all the rest of it, are banned. And citizens carry implanted transceivers. And with the resulting absence of any violent crime, it turns out that the police force in this future city, they've actually lost any ability to handle violence because there hasn't been any. So they just don't know what to do. And this is why the character played by Sylvester Stallone is brought out of his cryo prison, because he's sort of an action man from the past who can handle this. And the problem they've got on their hands is this guy called Simon Phoenix, played by Wesley Snipes. And he's an old school, ultra violent criminal. So for me, the film is replete with messages. And yes, you can get off on all the guns and explosions as John Spartan and Simon Phoenix fight it out. But it's the dystopic, you know, future society masquerading as a utopia that I find most interesting.
Yeah, the interesting idea there is the domestication concept. The entire population has become domesticated to such an extent that they've been pacified, where their what was survival instinct and fighting in certain situations where it's necessary to survive, that isn't necessary anymore because the state just kind of takes care of you, the nanny state concept. So it's the idea of if the nanny state succeeds and it lasts for a particular amount of time, how far would that go? So it's an exploration of that idea. It's a really good one. So yeah, I would agree with you there, Greg, too, in that it delves into that concept pretty well.
And one of the telling things about Demolition Man, and this has its parallel in many other similar films, is that inevitably there are people who say thanks but no thanks to this dumbed down utopian world. There is in Demolition Man, there's literally an underclass living in an underworld. They live underground. Yeah. Yeah. And that society is a lot more like the one that you and I would recognize. Yes, it's grubby around the edges. It smells a bit.
Yeah, again, that's a recurring theme.
Yeah, you know, people fight, they fornicate, you know, just it's more like the sort of society we recognize, but that's very much from the sort of clinical elite living, the technocrats living above ground is very much seen as horrible, seedy place. Why would you want to be part of it? But as the film unfolds, you discover the humanity of these people down there and how actually John Spartan, when he discovers them, identifies with them. He goes down there and he has a Pepsi and he has a what turns out to be a rat burger, but it's the best thing he's tasted since he's been, since he's come out of cryostasis, you know, because it's real food in a way. It might be a rat, but it tastes like something he can recognize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whenever I'm thinking along these lines, I mean, it's a real thing. Sometimes in my day-to-day life, I note this too. Like, just the way I see it is things that would make my sister-in-law say, ew. You know, she says, ew at certain things. I'm like, what's the problem with that? You know, she gets made uneasy by certain things that have been presented as gross or whatever, things like that. And a lot of things are like, it's not really that big a deal. It's just been made into a big deal. So what interests me is, why are certain things labeled as gross, as unrefined, as things that we should avoid? You know, what's the whole idea with making sure our hair is completely manicured, that we all look like George Stephanopoulos with a hair helmet before we go out for the day? Yes. Well, what's that all about? You know, that's what really turns me off, is that whole side of things. So I could be down there eating a rat burger and be happy too.
We'll hop on to another film, which again has one, for me, one really compelling central idea, and that's Minority Report, starring what's-his-face, old big nose, Tom Cruise. And that came out in 2002. And for me, the big idea there is pre-crime. In this future society, psychics are employed in a sort of preventative government strategy to so-called protect the citizenry. It deals also with issues of media, you know, in a future state where electronic advancements make it just boundless. It's everywhere. I mean, Minority Report was the first place I saw this idea of you walking into a mall and an advertising board would be able to identify who you are, what you've bought previously, and target a product at you. But as I say, the main idea is pre-crime, because that brings up the central idea in a future advanced technological society of free will versus determinism.
Yes. Yes, it does. Yeah, yeah. That film is loaded with these ideas, and definitely a film that has the power of prophecy going for it. And again, we're not talking about the 700 Club here. We're talking about the real power of prophecy that makes itself manifest in all sorts of popular culture. Pre-crime and free will, the debate over free will, the trying to, for the people who believe in free will is a tricky subject because it's not real unless it's only real for the people who choose to believe it's real. Or I don't even like to use the term believe, for the people who choose to employ it in their life, like they say that free will is the way they see things, and therefore free will exists. But if you dismiss free will, you say it doesn't exist. Lots of people do this. There's a lot of people on both sides of this argument here. For me, there's all sorts of problems that happen when you say free will does not exist. That comes with a whole host of issues. And this is such a bedrock existential issue, that of free will, that it's going to be important in the whole converging technology sense here. And it's fitting that Minority Report plays on this. Because I think that overall, if we had to say, give a blanket statement, I'd say that free will is discouraged in the mainstream. We're made to believe that there is no such a thing. There's not free will. It's only an illusion. We're kind of brought back into the more materialist, deterministic way of thinking. And that's a real shame, in my estimation, because I do think that free will exists. And I think that the effort in keeping even the idea of free will alive might get difficult in years to come if these trends continue. So it's we might have our work cut out for us as we believe in it.
Yeah, yeah, I very much agree with you. Diving back to the 1970s, which for me was the golden era of filmmaking, I don't think we'll see its like again. A film called THX-1138. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one.
It is, isn't it? Now, this is a science fiction film. It came out in 1971. It was actually Star Wars director George Lucas. It was his first film. It was based on one he actually did kind of at film school and developed it into this feature. Yep. Once again, a dystopian future in which the population are controlled through a combination of mandatory use of drugs, you know, just to suppress emotion, including sex drive, and android police officers that roam the place. Again, there's a ream of issues. If you've seen it, obviously you can comment. There's a ream of issues in there. And one thing I always wondered about it, particularly when I first watched it, was who's in charge? Because you look at it, you see these people are taking drugs to suppress all their emotions and all their drives and all their humanity. Android police officers going around the place. Somewhere, there has to be a Wizard Oz. You know, there has to be someone behind the curtain. Who's in charge? You know, I always wondered about that. Where is the elite? And I think that film is a good example of a technological elite who vanished from view.
Yeah. It could be, I don't know if it's implying this, but it kind of seems to, that the computer system with its AI has kind of taken over and runs things as, you know, as it would and as it sees fit. So, you know, he's sitting in that confession booth and the computer voice is asking him all these questions just to extract information out of him. It's done in a religious way, so it's sort of like a Catholic confessional. It's got the picture of the face that looks like a Jesus face on there too. So it's got that aspect, but it's only like a thin vestige of what used to be human religion that, I guess to keep human beings from totally revolting, you need to give them some kind of religion, but they're so drugged out that it doesn't take a whole lot. So you just give them that and that's enough to keep them from rebelling. But Yeah, no, it definitely kind of has that feeling like the machine has completely taken over and it's allowed humans to continue for some reason, but it's difficult to say what that reason would be.
Well, I think they're all engaged, if I remember rightly, in making technological items. So my only speculation on that is that maybe they're kept alive to make these things, which in turn keep the AI alive. And maybe there's a reason why the AI couldn't become completely self-replicating. There must be some reason why it needs the humans there.
Yeah. Yeah. So it becomes kind of like the humans become the organs of the AI machine's body, and the sort of macrocosmic view of civilization that you'll see actually in lots of places if you're looking for it. It's that idea again with the body as a whole being a machine, and the mind, the most important executive control center of the body, in this case, is the AI machine. So that's where the brain and the head are.
In the film, which stars Robert Duvall, by the way, just for people out there who haven't seen it and who are interested, his roommate is a woman. You know, without giving the plot away, at some point, well, of course I'm partially giving it away, what am I saying? But she substitutes his dumbing down drugs for sugar pills or something. So he's coming off these drugs, and she, in fact, is in love with him. And of course, for him, this is quite traumatic initially. Because he doesn't understand what's happening. He feels terrible. It's like someone coming off heroin. He's going through massive withdrawal, physical trauma, and he's starting to feel something for her. And this is, of course, completely alien to him. And he goes to the aforementioned Catholic-style confessional booth to talk to the computer system. And, of course, the computer system designed to respond very narrowly to human concerns. And at one point, he throws up in the booth because, again, he's coming off these drugs. He says to the computer, "Oh, I think I'm dying." And the computer goes, "Could you be more specific?"
Yeah. I remember that line all the time. More specific. Oh, goodness.
No, I can't be more fucking specific.
Yeah, it's constantly trying to get more and more information. It's always asking, "Can you be more specific?" Because the more information it has on you, the more intel it has on you.
Yeah.
So, interesting in the intelligence gathering sense, very real way to go about things.
Still back in the 1970s, another oldie but goodie for me is Logan's Run from 1976. That was a very successful and popular film. So I should ask you once again, is that one you managed to catch?
Yeah, I've actually seen that one, yeah.
Yeah, once again, dystopian future society in which the population and the consumption of resources are managed. This is all very zeitgeist, maintained in equilibrium. But of course, there's a price to this, because everyone, all the human population, once they reach the age of 30, they are killed off. No doubt painlessly, but nonetheless, killed off. And the idea is to prevent overpopulation. The story follows the actions of a character called Logan Five, hence the title. And he eventually, again, breaks out of conditioning, realizes what's going on. And he's 30, and you know what? He doesn't want to die. And this very much speaks to themes, I think, of controlled society, and what happens to the groups who don't want to be part of it. And eventually, the backstory to this is that they're all existing in these domed cities. And they're told that beyond this is a wasteland, forbidden zone to which they cannot go. And of course, in the film, ultimately, Logan breaks out of the city, meets an old man. You know, again, it's the idea that, oh, no, there's nothing out there. But actually, of course, there is. There's just a bit like the underworld in Demolition Man. There's the people who don't want to be part of this, and they've managed to survive somehow. And he gets taken back. The old man gets taken back into the city. And there's a common theme here with these dystopias. The whole thing collapses in on itself once people who are part of it realize that there's a bigger reality.
Yeah, that's an interesting movie. It's another one of those ones that, well, in this movie, the citizens are only given the short lifespan, but during that lifespan, it's a life of leisure. So again, they're chasing the hedonistic pleasures, which are oftentimes given as the ends to human existence. That's what we should be striving for. So you give it to the population, they're happy, supposedly. They are also, when they're killed off, it's done in this like religious context where they go to carousel. They call it carousel. It's an interesting term. Carousel is like a ring of animals, so it's like the zodiac, so it's kind of ringing religiously with that idea. But then they're actually killed in the carousel, but the idea is that they're not somehow. So the religious concept that you actually continue living when you don't, you die, but your life continues, you're told in the religion. So Logan's not happy with the life he's living. He's not happy with the religion he's giving. And yeah, he ends up breaking out. And it is interesting. And I guess another, it's got the hopeful side to it in that it's possible to do that. So I guess this movie has a very positive side in that regard, in that it encourages somebody that's possible to do, that you don't have to go along to get along. There's something else that you can do if you choose to. Might not be easy, but at least it's there as a possibility.
Yeah, a much more recent film that has many similarities with Logan's Run and also with THX-1138 is The Island from 2005. And that the plot of that, when it stars Ewan McGregor, and the plot revolves around the struggle of his character to fit into this highly structured future world that he lives in. And turns out, when we see the bigger picture, that these people are actually isolated in a compound, but of course they think that's the whole world, essentially. They know there's a world out there, but they think the only world worth living in is the one that they're part of. And a series of events unfold whereby he questions how truthful his reality is. And he then discovers that the inhabitants of the compounds are actually clones who are used for organ harvesting and surrogate motherhood for wealthy people in the outside world. And he breaks out and, you know, the plot unfolds. But once again, these recurring themes are cropping up.
Yeah, I've heard of that film. I haven't seen it. But, I mean, the idea of the island is one that isn't new. And it's used in this context a lot, where somebody builds up their own little world, and they live in that, and they're perfectly content to do so. The Plato's Cave idea, it's the exact same thing there.
Yeah.
The Paul Simon song, you know, or Simon Garfunkel, I am a rock, I am an island, that sort of thing. So it's returning to that concept, and if you never think about things outside of the context that you're given in which you live, then you're really doing yourself a disservice, certainly.
Flipping back to literature just for a moment again, it's one of the last works of fiction that I read, because a few years ago I sort of gave up reading fiction because there was so much non-fiction that I wanted to read. Almost felt I didn't have time for it. It wasn't, maybe I'll go back to it, I don't know, but this particular book was once again by Philip K. Dick, which I think is significant. It was called The Penultimate Truth. Is that one that you've heard of?
No, I certainly know Philip K. Dick, but I haven't heard of this one.
No, I've talked to other people actually who are big fans of his, and it's one that he hadn't read. But anyway, it's got some interesting themes. It came out in 1964, and it's set in a future where the bulk of humanity is kept in large underground shelters. And this is a bit like the scenario in THX-1138. And they're told that World War III, in some of these stories, the war is over, but above ground is a wasteland. But in The Penultimate Truth, they're told that World War III is actually ongoing. When in reality, the war, most of which had been conducted by what they call in the book Leadies, which are actually robots, you know, so we get the idea here of the, you know, the AI developed it, weaponized, and human beings taken out of the military type thing. And they were built to withstand the extreme radiation. So the government and the war engine remains on the surface with an elite of humanity who are apparently there because they're necessary. Their leader delivers inspirational speeches to the people who live underground. Again, sounds a bit like 1984, you know, war is peace, keep the faith, we're doing what needs to be done, motivating them to increase their production of these robots and win the war. But of course, let's just say the war is long gone, and it turns out that no matter what's going on underground, the controllers above are living in luxury villas in private parks, and the robots that are being built underground, supposedly to fight a war, are actually serving their every whim. and the story revolves around one of the people living underground, eventually, again, breaking out to the surface and discovering the truth and the whole thing coming crashing down. So again, it's really well written, and being Philip K. Dick, I'd recommend it to anyone. I think it would make a great movie, actually, but it's just striking that those themes come up yet again.
Yeah, that kind of, the idea that war is an act is a very powerful one, and it ties to the concept of the world stage, something that I think is very important, the concept of the world stage, and that so much of what we're given as current events, news, important happenings in the world are staged to a great deal. Yeah, yeah, they're real in a sense, but how real are they? And this gets, it sounds silly to say that, but certainly the way that you spin any given story, you can make it into a whole news story, and you can add on details that aren't necessarily part of the reality of it. So the blurring of reality and fiction is a very real phenomenon in the world. And when it comes to war and the world stage, well, often you'll hear that it's a theater of war. Just that term alone is like, well, it's a theater? Isn't a theater where I go to see a play and relax? You know, that's what I think of a theater. I think of war as a place where people are getting killed and there's horror going on. So what's the relation between theater and war? And also the term act of war. Oh, this is an act of war. Yeah, yeah. Well, this is the second act of a play I'm watching, you know? Like,
yeah.
The whole world stage thing is fascinating to me. And I have no doubt that wars are put out for public perception and inflated and exaggerated. The war on terror, certainly not the least of which, to get the people all worked up and anxious and excited, and the strategy of tension where everybody's tense. There's a whole lot of that making much ado about nothing. So it is a theater oftentimes, and it's all just make-believe, and somebody wrote it into existence, a playwright with their pen. They wrote a war into existence. Not to say that real wars don't happen, that the United States government doesn't bomb other countries for horrible reasons, and that certainly happens, but...
For fun and profit.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of both. It's really crazy.
One more movie from the 70s, another personal favorite of mine. From 1975, Rollerball with James Caan. Is that one you managed to catch?
You know what? It sounds so familiar, but I don't think I have seen it.
It's the one where they fight in what looks like a speedway track, and they're on motorbikes, and they're sort of it's future violent sport as a sort of panacea for the masses. If you haven't seen it, it's well worth a look, because again, it's another film full of interesting allegories and messages wrapped up in a violent action film. Set in 2018, so we'll be seeing that soon. And there's a global corporate state. Basically, instead of governments, we have corporations, energy, transport, luxury, housing, communication, and they operate on a global basis. There's no war, there's no want, but once again, there are elites and there's the rest of us. The most interesting things that come out of this film, and I know you can speak to this anyway because they're general ideas, but this film brought them home to me. One point in the film, the protagonist, say James Caan, becomes, again, suspicious of what he's being told, the information that he's being fed, his role as a leading sports star. What role is he really portraying in society? He's been told he has to retire because he's too good at what he does and he doesn't want to retire. He goes to visit the central computer base where all human knowledge is being classified, transcribed, and stored. He's disappointed to find out that there's no books in the library. They've all been put on this computer. And for me, it raised interesting ideas at first about cloud storage, because this big computer system is water-based, or at least liquid-based, which is interesting in itself when you read some of the things about does water have a memory. But when he quizzes this computer about the past, the present, what's going on, what his role is, who's in control, the computer appears to be senile. Its responses are gibberish. It won't answer what he wants. It just appears to be incoherent. And this led me to this fascinating idea. We've been talking about AI, about cyborgs, about uploading brains, you know, to outlive bodies, on and on and on. Who's to say that there couldn't be new types of mental illness that could affect AI? What about that? What about a computer in control of everything? Getting Alzheimer's, the equivalent of, you know, who's to say?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you never know. You never know what's going to pop up when you start making projects, like when you carry out projects like this of artificial intelligence or what have you. That's just the nature of it. It's something that you have to realize as a reality of technological development, is that any problems you might be taking care of in using the technology, whatever the technology was developed to do, well, there's going to be other problems that come as a result of just that technology existing now. And that's something that gets ignored a lot, and ignored when you're talking about developing technology to alleviate the problems we already have. Well, it's going to create more problems. So, you know, it's not like you're ever going to get rid of problems. And then certain folks would say that you're going to have even more problems than you started out with just by developing more and more technology. That's one way of looking at it. And I think that might actually be true. Jacques Ellul wrote along these lines about technology, that we just pretend that it solves all the problems, when in actuality makes so many more. So that's something to realize. And yeah, the AI concept is so weird, because even another way of looking at that, the senile AI, is, well, how do you know if it is malfunctioning, or perhaps it's working perfectly? It's just, you know, putting on a front, maybe, because it doesn't want to give forth any information to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe it works in such a weird way that you can't even decode it anymore. So yeah, all your books you put on there are lost, because they're in that weird system that makes no sense to a human mind.
Well, it's a bit like HAL 9000 in 2001, isn't it? That he, quote-unquote, malfunctions, but actually, as the computer understands it, this is completely logical, rational, and necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was another film, actually, from the 70s called Saturn III, which actually stars Kirk Douglas and an early appearance by Harvey Keitel. And that raises another interesting issue in terms of man and machine merging, because Keitel's character, Captain Benson, I won't go into the back plot, it's an interesting film in itself, but he is able to link his brain to a robot, and that's fine up to a point, except there's a complication. Benson's a psychopath. And lo and behold, that AI system becomes infected with his tendencies, and it ends up actually killing him and running amok on its own. So I guess the message here, what I'm trying to drive at, is human-machine interface won't necessarily eradicate human problems, human psychoses, human thinking, human fallibility. And what would human fallibility look like writ large on a immortal, you know, omniscient technological system?
Yeah, yeah. If you're expanding it in all senses, then the bad aspects would be expanded along with the good. Yeah, that's a real thing. And with psychopathy, and that's a misunderstood area of human human personality. That's one that a lot of people really misunderstand, don't realize as being a reality, that there are psychopaths out there. So that kind of makes light of the situation of, well, if we don't understand ourselves and those among us that are dangerous and have a wholly different sort of consciousness than what we do, non-psychopathic people, then, you know, what are we doing creating these machines that will have God knows what kind of consciousness? It could be something like a psychopathic consciousness. It could be something completely different. As we're saying, it's going to be something completely different than what we're used to. So how are we going to deal with that? If we don't know how to deal with each other, and those of us that are different, how are we going to deal with that?
Have you seen a film from 1977 called Demon Seed?
Oh, no, I've never seen that one.
Well, this involves the forced impregnation of a woman by an AI system called Proteus 4, an artificial intelligence which incorporates what the film calls a quasi-neural matrix. And the sum of all human knowledge is fed into this system. And over the course of this, Proteus then starts to become self-aware and wants to be told when it will be allowed out of its box, which is a very sinister development. It's part horror, part sci-fi, but Proteus decides it wants to exist in a form that will not, it cannot be shut down and will be accepted by humanity. So basically kidnaps the scientist who created his wife and impregnates her with synthetic sperm and gives birth to a child in less than a month. I won't give away the plot, as I've done with some of these other films, but towards the end, when this child is born, Proteus then self-destructs, saying, okay, I said I would do this. And the scientist, well, he's dead at this point, actually, but the other protagonists approach this incubator to see what this baby looks like. And it's quite a surprise, to say the least. But it's just the idea underlying this film, I guess, is the system becoming self-aware and then learning at a geometric rate, and how you then lose control of that.
Yeah. Sounds a little bit like Rosemary's Baby too, where you've got this supposedly demonic energy that works its way into the human sexual act and impregnates a woman to create this demon baby. And so this otherworldly entity somehow gets born into the material world, and that's the way of crossing over between the spiritual or ethereal or whatever you want to say, intangible world into the tangible world. So that's a creepy kind of concept, way of thinking. I think it's valid to think along those lines, though, however. And it just strikes me from your description there that there are parallels between those two films.
Yeah, definitely there are. I hadn't actually thought of that, but you're very, very right. And I suppose the logical end, or illogical end, depending on your perspective, of machines taking over and humanity as a cancer, is it like in Terminator, you know, with Skynet, that the people behind it think they're doing the right thing? Let's take human decisions out of this system so it's not emotional, it's not irrational, it's not illogical. But then the system becomes something else and says, oh, okay, I see the real problem here, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It looks after its own best interest, right? That only makes sense. Why wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was, like, as I said, with HAL in 2001, you know, albeit HAL was serving a mission, but he was still willing to kill the humans, you know, aboard the spaceship in order to do that. In terms of consciousness existing outside the body, there was one film that I remember enjoying, a film called Brainstorm from 1983. And it follows the efforts of a research team to perfect a system that directly records the sensory and emotional feelings of a subject's, you know, linked up to their system. And of course, behind all of this is a military mission, basically, to weaponize this. And a team of scientists working on it, they invent this brain-computer interface that allows human sensations and emotions to be recorded. But it gets very interesting. Not only does one of the scientists, he gets dismissed from the program, actually, but he records himself having sex on the system. And again, this can be, the idea is it can be played back to other people who will then experience it. But one of the scientists, she has a heart attack and dies while she's on the system. And for me, that's very interesting, this idea of a computer brain interface taken to that kind of level. And of course, in the film, it unfolds. You see the team as the military are running around after them, trying to weaponize this in some way. But it's a fascinating, fascinating piece of work.
Yeah, and again, it brings in that sexual aspect too, and the whole sexual energy being a huge focus in occult practices. And I would, again, stress the fact that occult practices find their way into the whole transhuman project quite intimately. And you'll find that is the case when you look into these things to any sort of depth. So these fictions, these pieces of fiction in popular culture are pointing in that direction, quite correctly so. Sometimes they're promoting it sort of in an underhanded way as a good thing, and they're sort of hiding the reality of that in that it's fiction. In other senses or in other instances, I think they're trying to expose that sort of thing and bring the audience to attention to those sorts of things, and that occult topics are actually quite real, and it's something to be concerned about. And they're wrapped up in very things that we would take as materialistic, as mundane, as purely science, scientific. The Transhuman Project, if we want to be completely naive about it, is just a science project and nothing more. We're just furthering science with this, and as a result, everything's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. The occult is just a bunch of mumbo-jumbo nonsense that only people who believe in the Easter Bunny and things like that, you know, like people who are still children at heart believe in these things and nothing more. That's, you know, that's a paradigm we're living under. Those are sorts of sweeping overgeneralizations we're given to believe is truth. They're not at all. So I hope that people are sort of coming around to the reality of the situation we're in here, which is much deeper and more interesting reality than the one we're given to believe. So that's kind of the positive spin on things here, I would say.
Now, the very final film I want to throw out for today touches upon virtual reality. And again, this is something that crops up when we're talking about transhumanism. Could perhaps a virtual reality is somewhere that we could live forever? And the film in question, I never figured out how to pronounce it. It's either Existenz or Existence. 1999 film by David Cronenberg. And as with his previous film, Videodrome, it makes a psychological statement about humans react and interact with technology around them. And in the case of Existenz, it's the world of video games. Now, the film's interesting in a number of levels, particularly with its biotech aspect and the merging of man and machine. You know, the players of the game have sort of ports installed at the base of their spine so they can plug into the system. There is a so-called realist underground who are resisting all of this game playing because they want to live in the real world. You know, they're very much about that. But for me, the main message of the film is that if we ever perfect virtual reality, it's over. Never again will we know what is real. Are we in the real world? Are we not? And at the end of the film, there's three of the protagonists and one of them shoots one of the others. And the third one looks horrified. And he turns to her and says, "We're still in the game, right?"
He doesn't know. Yeah. Yeah, this is, oh my goodness, there's so much to think about in that regard. But I would agree overall that virtual reality does come with this problem inherent in it, that you can become so immersed in it and becomes your real reality that you can't distinguish fact from fiction, reality from fiction, the blurring of the line of reality and fiction. I sort of mentioned that earlier. That's a very real phenomenon that is real today, even without virtual reality. We're not existing in a virtual reality. However, we are taken away and driven to madness by a propaganda and the theater of war that we're given on the TV. How much of that is real? How much of it is spin? How much of it's just pure propaganda? Well, if we're not thinking about that, we get carried away and we don't even think to ask those questions anymore. So I'd say the more soft form of that phenomenon is alive and well today, and most of the people are not paying enough attention to that. If you take virtual reality to its extreme ends, we're going to get that multiplied by 100 times or who knows how much more. It's going to get ridiculous to the point where things get so, I'm trying to think of the word here. You get so dissociated from yourself that there is no self anymore, even perhaps. It's hard to even project that far, but dissociation, to say the least, is the issue at hand there.
Well, Aaron, as we draw things to a close for today, I just want to touch upon a couple of other areas briefly. We've mostly been talking about movies and books, but we talked in our first interview the idea about post-genderism, about moving beyond the so-called narrow confines of male and female. Two areas that I get you to comment on are fashion and music. In terms of fashion, I've noticed a trend here, and I'm showing my age, no doubt, in the modern media, that androgyny has kind of been the thing for quite a while. I mean, you could say it has been in music since the days of David Bowie or whatever, but when it comes to fashion and look and what is seen as the latest style, young men today are often come across as frail and effeminate. Now, if you're a young man and you're frail and effeminate, that's fine, whatever.
Yeah, sure.
You are what you are, you know. I don't have an issue with that. But it seems to me there's a very conscious move away from any portrayal of men as, you know, more traditional male roles. Today it's a bit like Charlton Heston versus Justin Bieber, you know, the idea of what men wear. And again, I'm not trying to hold up any conservative ideals here. I'm really not. I'm just commenting on what you see portrayed in the media. It seems to be, you know, this blurring of the lines that I personally find a little bit disturbing.
Yeah, well, for a long time, I definitely agree that media does give certain standards of beauty, of what's considered desirable, that sort of thing, definitely. Fashion and music all do this too. But for a long time, with the female, I think they started with females and sort of promoting females that weren't necessarily they didn't have overly feminine characteristics. They're more sort of the super thin. They're very thin, not a whole lot of shape to them. You know, very androgynous and that sort of thing. Those were seen as the epitome of beauty for whatever reason. That's been a long trend, and people have been complaining about that with good reason for a long time. So I think that's well established, actually. But they're moving more into portraying men that are more androgynous as the ideal now. They moved away from just women in fashion, and they're bringing men into it. And beyond that, they're the concept of fashion, which is considered a feminine sort of thing, the cosmetics industry and that, obviously aimed at women. But there is a push to get men involved in that too, and men doing things like wearing makeup and carrying handbags and being concerned about fashion, overly concerned about fashion. That's something that men haven't been concerned with because they haven't been told to be concerned with it in one regard. I'll say that. I mean, the power of persuasion and propaganda works. So you can persuade men to be concerned just as much as women, almost, I would have to say. With transhumanism, it's interesting because Ray Kurzweil has made little comments in this regard too, where he's mentioned that, you know, men haven't been as interested in wearing makeup because of cultural reasons, and he was sure to say that. But in the future, they will be, and it's actually pointing towards this whole transhuman thing. And it was just interesting that he said that. It was one of those things, as with almost every other word he says, that to me just sounded like something he was told to say, something he was put up on a stage to mention for whatever particular reason to promote the transhuman agenda and even greater agendas beyond that. So there is a link between these sorts of things, I do think. And you're also right to point out that it does sound like you're kind of you can sound overly conservative when you talk about this, but it doesn't mean that that these things aren't happening. I think we need to recognize that they are.
We could talk about this all day, and the sheer amount of time we've already spent on it demonstrates the depth of the issues, I think. But we're done for now, so tell folks about your website. There they can access your book, your documentary. You also do podcasts. Just share that and anything else you'd like to put out there.
Well, yeah, thank you very much, Greg. My website is ageoftransitions.com. You can find all my material there. I have my book, Revolve Man's Scientific Rise to Godhood. Check that out. I have the first chapter available for free if you want to read that as a PDF. I have my film, Age of Transitions. You can watch it there. And I have my podcast, Trans Resistor Radio, which I'm quite proud of. And I produce that on a regular weekly basis now, so you might want to subscribe to that. I do the other podcast, Themes and Memes, with my friend Adam, where we dissect films and popular culture in the way that we did today, Greg. So if you enjoyed today's show, you're definitely going to want to check out Themes and Memes. You can find that at my website as well, majortransitions.com.
Excellent. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thank you very much for having me, Greg.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were 7 UK pounds, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.
Utopia! 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 planet of your wildest dreams. Welcome to Utopia, where all your needs are catered for, anticipated, calculated. All your wants are monitored, programmed, computer formulated. We know you will be very happy here. Nobody has ever complained. Yet. But we always encourage making a utopian love. Welcome to Utopia. 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 Welcome to Utopia.